Well, hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Art Connects 19 podcast with me, Nick Causton from Steam Co. This is an absolute corker. You're going to hear from some of the most inspiring educators in the UK today. Unbelievable. It's quite a crazy story of when I went up to Edinburgh to the Portobello Learning Festival, organised by an incredible guy called David Cameron. He bills himself as the real David Cameron, so no imposters here. Heard from an incredible talk by Paul Dix, Hugh Roberts, you're going to hear from Nina Jackson, a head teacher from a school in Edinburgh, and the main event, a fantastic conversation with a lady called Suzanne Zedek, who just sums it up. The Art of Babies is what this is called, because she is the most incredible research scientist, child psychologist, whatever. Just the insights that she brings are just wonderful. I'm sitting here now with two boys aged 15 and 17. I wish I knew this stuff when they were, well, before they were born or as they were born. Just wonderful. But I really want to rewind because I'm on a crazy journey. I'm on a crazy journey with Steam Co. You can't make this stuff up. And I just want to rewind to the very end of May. It was a Friday evening, and I was sitting there wondering what I was going to do for the weekend. And I saw that an educator, a good friend now actually, Ed Finch, who is a teacher in a primary school in Oxford, was running a thing called the Oxford Reading Spree. So I messaged him and said, hey, is there any chance I could come down, put a few pamphlets out on the table at the back? He said, hey, yeah, no problem. Why don't you say a few words? Which, if you know me, is like a red rag to a bull. So I said, fantastic. So I convinced my youngest son to come with me. We packed everything into the car, took the little trailer and rocked up down there. Filled the trailer, went into the hall, and it gave me 10 minutes. And I decided overnight that what I was going to do was not only announce that I'm writing a book, but write a book. So I announced and I did a talk to launch the hashtag Rocket Kid Stories, which was basically 9 short stories about inspiring men and women, which are basically the spin-off from the half-day Rocket Kids session that I do in school communities all over the country, inspired by Homer Hickam's Rocket Boys book, where I go in, do a 45-minute to an hour assembly. It's now pushing an hour and a quarter. I've got to cut some bits out. I then make rockets with a class of kids, then we fire a dynamite rocket off in the playground, and then have a bit of a meeting with any parents or teachers who are interested in working with us. So it's kind of like the Trojan horse for Steam Co. So anyway, I announced I'm writing this book. And in the audience, I said, right, who wants a copy of this Rocket Boys book? Held it up and just chucked it into the audience. Son chucked his hand up. And I said, are you a dad? He said, yeah. I said, are you a teacher? He said, no, I'm a head teacher of a school in Leicester. I said, okay, great, well, enjoy that. And in the next few days, I tweeted him and connected with him. Matt Peters' name was at Momaker School. And it was just remarkable. I went into his school a week later in Leicester to run one of these days. He invited me in. He paid me to do it. It was just fantastic. And we had the most wonderful day. And this is what Matt had to say when I collared him in the playground.
That was absolutely brilliant. What a fantastic day. The kids have absolutely loved it, bringing all our parents together, bringing the community, especially our dads. Our dads have had a great day building those rockets. You know, it's all about art. It's all about that connection. Absolutely brilliant. If you can get this man into your school, bring him in. The kids will have a great day. Fantastic.
And I think what's been brilliant, the community engagement. We've had some parents in, we've done robots, we've done rockets, we've done coding, we've done inventing.
Absolutely, and every parent I've spoken to today have said of how fantastic it is to actually be within our classroom, working with our children. They've loved the coding. We need to get some of those little bits into school, so that's absolutely fantastic. They've loved the robots, you know, the Rubik Cube, how brilliant was that? Absolutely fantastic, and I think actually finishing today with the rockets launching them, every child had a fantastic time.
Really lovely feedback, and it was a fantastic day. I mean, we worked with a whole range of parents, clearly from a wide socio-economic background, I can't even say it. And there clearly was a lot of deprivation in that community, but the commitment, the enthusiasm and the excitement was just wonderful. So I finished in Leicester that day. BBC Radio Leicester picked up on it. So we ended up on BBC Radio Leicester with a mum and her son, where he talked, it was lovely actually, talking about how much he loves reading and reading with his parents. After that, I was sitting in the car and I didn't really know what to do. And I'd seen that there was a conference, Friday afternoon conference with somebody who I really love. He's got does fantastic work. Nina Jackson was doing an event with David Cameron in Edinburgh on the next day, the Friday. So I contacted David and said, hey, this looks great. I'm thinking of coming up. You know, would I be able to get a ticket? He said, well, actually, why don't you come and say a few words, maybe do a warm up for Nina Jackson? I couldn't believe it. So I literally, instead of going back to London, I drove to Edinburgh, like you do. I ended up finding an Airbnb up on the northeast coast, far corner of northeast of Northumbria, just on the Scottish border, and then rocked up in Edinburgh the next day. And to wrap it all up, now to get to the main event, the talk with Suzanne Zeedek, it was something to see. It really blew me away. She did the opening keynote speech of that day, where she talked about babies and child psychology and child development in the very, very early days, the first weeks, in fact, of anything. In fact, pre-birth. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope you enjoy this as much as the other Art Connects 19 podcast we've done with Matthew Taylor, CEO of the RSA, Kirsty Williams, the Welsh Education Minister, and Richard Gerver, who's a global educator, innovation leadership consultant and guru, just fantastic. If you do like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from, iTunes, Google, Spotify, Deezer, whatever, and please put a couple of little stars, whatever it is, in there, and some reviews, because we need to get the word out on this stuff, because the feedback I'm getting is absolutely fantastic. I hope you enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the amazing, the inspiring Suzanne Zeedek. Suzanne, I mean, could you recap for everybody who wasn't there today about the theme and what was behind what you're talking about? It was just incredible.
I'd be delighted to. I'm a developmental psychologist by training, and the key insight that I have and that I'm fascinated by is that babies come into the world already connected. So babies are born knowing the sound of their mother's voice. They know whether she laughs and reads stories and sings, or whether she cries and shouts a lot. And I think that is amazing. We didn't used to know that, but we do now. You come into the world already knowing the sound of your mother's voice and her emotional state. And you have begun to develop a brain in expectation of that. And you would know the voices of anybody else who's there on a daily basis, your dad, your big sister, your gran. And so that one little example helps us to think about what it means to say that babies arrive already connected to other people with a biology and a brain that is wired, expecting and needing connection, and that you go on to be, your biology is influenced by the experiences you have of connection, whether they feel safe and attuned or whether they feel scary and disjointed. And that has huge implications.
You say we only discovered that relatively recently. What, I'm tempted to say, well, what were we doing before that? Were we just mucking? Were mothers just taking that for granted, or too busy doing the washing?
That's a great question. When I say we in that sentence, the key thing I really meant was that the scientists. Lots of mothers will and fathers will intuitively know a version of what I just described. On the other hand, lots of people won't. And partly we don't know that because you learn about babies and how to interact with them from your culture. And our culture often has an unexamined idea that babies aren't very sophisticated, that they become people about the time they start to talk, that they're too young to remember things anyway, that they don't notice what goes on around them. None of that's true. Science has now been able to develop, especially since the 1970s, when we got more sophisticated ways of of doing research with. We have come to understand just how observant they are, how they calculate. Their brain is like kind of keeping track of what happens. And a mathematical calculation is not quite the way to describe it, but something like that. Your brain keeps track of, do most of my experiences feel safe and connected with you, or do they feel kind of disconnected and therefore anxious? And then you start to develop expectations of the world.
So that insight was made, that academic discovery was made in
1970s.
In the 1970s by academics. what happened to that evidence? What activity? What education? What did that inform in society? Anything?
Those are great questions, because I was an academic for 20 years at the University of Dundee, and it's now 8 years ago I took the decision to step away from full-time academic research work in order to try to translate this information for the wider public. And so that's what I now do full-time. Interesting. The really interesting question for me is, how do we learn what science has discovered? There is no job, there is no person, there is no role that does that. And science has discovered a lot of really interesting insights that I think parents and teachers and early year staff and social workers and doctors and police officers, people want to know this stuff. And one of the questions becomes, by what mechanism, how would you learn that? Because some of it makes you think about things you've never thought about, like baby buggies. If babies are born reading connection and needing connection, which direction do our baby buggies face?
Why?
They mostly face out. Okay, a baby won't have what's called object permanence until they're about 9 months old. So when you turn your baby out, if your baby can't see you, hear you, smell you, feel your warmth, feel the rhythm of your body, they don't know you're there. But most parents don't know that, because how would they learn that? Most buggy companies don't seem to know that, so they can't tell parents that as they're buying buggies. Buggies aren't designed with that in mind. There are huge implications of just some of those very basic understandings of infant development. But if we don't have those in our culture, and we don't have a way of getting that to then we don't disseminate in the way that I think most parents would like to know and deserve to that. And here's one of the fascinating insights. Really getting this stuff about connection is tricky. It's scary. People have feelings about it. I sometimes make the joke that if I studied moon rocks, most people don't have feelings about moon rocks. You're either really fascinated by them because you're a bit geeky, or you think they're boring. But that's not the case when you study babies. People have feelings about our sense of connection to babies and therefore what this information means. So the way you describe it and the words you use to talk about this stuff is as important as the information itself. So what do we start to do about the fact that there's not very much work on buggies? And look, I've just pulled buggies out as an example.
Well, no, I think it's a perfect example. I mean, I'm running a single steam cone. There's an engineering angle to that. And buggies, the McLaren baby buggy is the most popular buggy probably on the planet. I know for a fact. Do you know who designed it? Do you know the design story? So it wasn't designed by a mum. It wasn't a child-centered design. It was designed by a bloke who's very clever at folding bits of metal for aircraft undercarriages, wasn't it?
And do you know, it was built for his daughter.
Yeah.
He saw his daughter struggling with the really big buggies that we used to
cross,
have.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to do something to help. He invented what became the umbrella stroller during the 1960s as cars were shifting. So used to be people didn't have cars. Right, but as we have a society where cars grew, you need to be able to fold up your buggy and put it in the boot. When you think about it that way, it naturally gives rise to new kit. It's basically a form of technology. Nobody describes buggies as technology, but they are. They're baby transport. For the whole of our evolutionary history as human beings, babies were not transported in buggies. They were transported in parents' arms and on their back. And it's in the 1800s, Queen Victoria has a massive impact on people purchasing what at that point were prams, like Silver Cross prams. Our society began to shift and our babies were transported differently. And once you point it out, what I love is people go, oh, I never thought about that before. But it's obvious. That will be changing their development. Now, we don't have enough research to investigate how. There's been, I can tell you that if you exchange language, that you exchange with your baby doubles.
Well, you showed a film today, and I'd be good if we can get that link somehow into this podcast, but could you describe that film and the implications of that film that you showed and the context of that?
Sure. The film that I showed is called The Still Face Paradigm, and it was developed by developmental psychologists in the 1980s to demonstrate what happens if your baby experiences you as into. In the film, it's just a mom and her baby having a lovely conversation. And the baby is attuned and they're laughing and the whole audience smiles. And then you ask the mother to hold her face still in the conversation. She simply doesn't respond now to the baby's cues. And what you watch is the baby become distressed. And I watch the audience facial expressions change as they realize how quickly a baby is affected by a mismatch from the parent. And then it helps if you're courageous enough to think about tricky insights. What happens if a baby grows up in a world, in a family, in a setting where the adults are not able to attune, to match, to pay attention, to pick up the baby's bids? And that can happen for all sorts of reasons. The parents are really stressed. The parents are living in adversity that overwhelms them, like poverty. That is not to say that all families living in poverty won't be able to tune into their baby, but you know what? Poverty is a terrible way to live. So of course they're more stressed. Maybe parents are carrying their own unresolved trauma. Maybe they have a really difficult relationship with their partner. If you have parents who are stressed, then they can't tune into their babies, and the baby notices
that. They pick it up,
and it begins to influence the development of their biology. And then if I take that more widely in our culture again, so we've already said we carry babies in buggies. We put babies in car seats that are by law required to face to the back of the seat. So now you can't see your parent driving either, and you're required to do that by law. We have big discussions about babies sleeping on their own in their own room, about controlled crying. Those are just some of the debates that parents have. Okay, but if you think the baby is in the middle of experiencing all of those things across the day. So if some of those are difficult in any way, it will feel different for a baby for whom only that one thing is difficult and the others feel connected. Or for a baby for whom all of those experiences are difficult and uncomfortable. And if that starts to for that relationships with other people feel safe or they feel a bit anxious, then you carry that with you as you grow. And so when you get to classrooms, and we've been doing a lot of talking about that here at the Learning Festival, the difficult behavior that you see, and I'm doing this little quotey thing with my fingers at the moment, the difficult behavior or the challenging behavior or what a growing number of schools call what is that behavior communicating about the child's needs and their stress state that's driving that distressed behavior. What if that goes all the way back to their babyhood?
Well, I was going to interject a moment ago because you've described poverty. I was going to say you've described fairly marginal circumstances, but you haven't, because in certain communities poverty is endemic, especially in many areas. Trumping all that is something I saw the other day in Leicester city centre, which we all are very aware of. I was sat in a noodle bar after a session there, and a mother was with three children, and one child was in a buggy, two children were running around, and she was pushing the buggy, but she was staring at her phone the entire length of the street. Now, the mobile phone and that black mirror is the elephant in every single family home, and I'm as bad as anybody else, and my excuse is my kids are teenagers, they don't need my eye contact, but they certainly need the attention of a parent as much as anybody else does.
And do they ask you to put down that phone sometimes, Nick?
Very rarely.
Okay.
But occasionally. Very, very rarely, and they're probably just as bad. But we'd never have phones at a table, a meal table.
Okay, so you have some rules around that you have consciously developed.
Yeah.
And if at any point they do want your attention and your given it to the phone, they can articulate, they can ask for it. We now live in a world that changed 10 years ago for the whole we didn't used to have these things that are so easily distracting and that we're addicted to, basically, in the middle of this conversation with your baby. And so, especially for parents today, they've grown up with those. And for many people, that phone in itself is calming for the adults.
It connects them in this world of babiness, doesn't it? Mothers used to go crazy on their own, didn't they? And now they've got the connection to all the mums on Mum's Net or whatever. But
so if the baby experiences you looking at your phone as the baby being ignored, and the big word there is
if. So was there an as or is?
I said if the baby experiences you looking at your phone as you ignoring the baby.
Yeah.
In other words, the baby has an emotional experience of their relationships with other people. And we're just often not aware of that. And so anybody who's listening to this and hears this example that you just brought up, I don't want them to feel. That's the tricky thing. That's what I meant earlier. People have feelings about this stuff. And it's perfectly understandable. Anyone listening to this might rethink their, you know, whatever they did with their baby earlier today or yesterday, and they had a mobile phone in their hands. And so the way we talk about this is really important. I don't want people to feel guilty. People don't know. So one question is, how do we help people to become aware of
this?
That's
exactly what I'm thinking now.
Without
it's a government information
shame pay that doesn't shame pay that doesn't shame pay that doesn't shame parents, that doesn't make them feel guilty, that can be done in a way that helps people to feel curious. Because if I give one other example, one frame of thinking about this is called attachment theory. And attachment theory started in the 1950s, 40s really, but in the 1950s with hospital practice. So it was standard practice in the 1950s for parents not to be able to stay with their children. So you could easily go away on a Tuesday and not be allowed to come back until a Saturday between 3 and 4 because that was your visiting hours. There were attachment theorists, scientists who were worried that that wasn't good for children. And so they tried to help to get nurses and doctors to help them think through what would be more attuned hospital policies. And when they tried to talk about that in the 1950s and 60s, all hell broke loose because the nurses felt conflicted to think that their standard, well-meaning practice could be harming children. How do we talk and think about that? And so it took 2 decades to start to get real shift for parents to be able to stay with their children. And today's parents may have no idea that their ability to stay with their children in hospital came because there were big controversial discussions in the 50s and 60s.
Because any change to a system implies criticism or fault
exactly.
in the current status quo, and sometimes it's too politically dangerous to go there and criticize a system, isn't it?
It's politically dangerous, or feels politically dangerous. It's going to change power structures, but one of the key problems with change in this area is that people feel badly when they discover that the way they've been doing things could have damaged children. So that's why I today talk so much about courage, talked so much about curiosity. If we can find ways to talk about this science, some of which we've known for decades, some of which is newer, we now understand more about brain development. If we can find ways to think about these tricky things with curiosity and courage, then we can give our children the things they need. Then we can develop policies, which are the kind of policies we wanted in the first place. We can think of ways to talk to each other in ways that bring about the kind of change that I think most people want. If we stay in touch with our intentions, then I think Scotland is on the cusp. I really think we could make some really positive changes, but it will need lots of curiosity and courage on our part. And it's one of the reasons I love this festival.
It's been a remarkable day, and some of the things you're describing reminds me of what little I know about the Sure Start programme, which, funny enough, my father was very instrumental in Shropshire, where I was growing up. And that's been under a lot of pressure with funding. Did Scotland have an equivalent with Sure Start Scottish in Scotland as well?
The implications of that stretched across the whole of the UK.
Right, so there's early years investment.
What I can tell you is the collapse of the Sure Start centres is dumb. It was just dumb.
Yeah.
So I'm choosing really strong language on purpose. Yeah. It was dumb. And actually, you don't need a lot of science to tell you that. Parents who are struggling need support. We were not designed to raise our children in the absence of other adult support. You can't contain, you can't help your child to cope with their distress with immature bodies and brains if you're not calm. So the way we raise our children, often in nuclear families, without parents having non-judgmental support from other parents, is not the way human beings. So Sure Start Centers did that. And some new data just came out that showed that it had reduced hospital admissions. So that reduces costs.
Of children.
Yes, that children, there were fewer hospital admissions as a result of the Sure Start programs. And so now, if the collapse of those drives hospital and admissions, and I think wider use of the practices, if it drives that back up, the costs with that go up. So we need to be really curious, because we have cheated those families of that support when the whole system, there was a whole network now of them available. Why would we do that? Why are we dumb enough to both to put families back into distress and to waste money that way? I want us to ask tougher, harder, more sensitive, braver questions. And of course, part of that is tied up in the politics. Our children's development is massively shaped by the political context in which they grow up as babies and young children. And on the one hand, that's obvious. And on the other hand, I think we don't think about it enough.
It's interesting, you know, the Sure Start thing. My sons were young, I used to have a day off a week, and I went to the Sure Start Centre, and technically it wasn't there in theory for the kind of middle class sort of families, although I was very grateful for the service and the time and the company. What are the alternatives, or what else is there to provide that support? Because a lot of the affluent families don't consider they should be going to those drop-in centres. Okay. Where do people get those skills? Is it the birthing kind of club thing that everybody, all the sort of middle-class families go to before they have children? The antenatal clubs, or like whatever they are.
National childbirth trust. Isn't that interesting?
It's just a middle-class kind of cheese and wine networking thing, as far as I could see. But
you've hit on something important, though. Sometimes when we develop these political, when programs come out of a political frame of what we're trying to do in society, it's very easy to make it sound like we're only going to do this for those disadvantaged communities over there, because of course they need help. Actually, that comes with a lot of judgment and shame. So it's as if somehow there are these other groups over here who don't need support or need a different kind of support. Every human being on this planet needs help and support raising their babies. And so if we could think in a more comprehensive, in a more inclusive way, that would build the kind of communities that we need. But we bring with us a lot of judgment. That's where class comes from. So here's a different kind of pressure. Since you've said middle class, lots of middle class parents have an expectation that their children will begin doing all that academic stuff really early, so that by the, so that we start to do letters and numbers early, so that we start to prepare them for school, so that they're school ready. No child should be school ready. Schools should be children ready. And that means that we need a lot more diversity across children's capacities and what children need. The expectation that our children will be able to engage in formal learning so early is not developmentally informed. There's just tons of evidence. Children need a play-based education, but we don't think of education as play. We think of it as sitting down and working at a desk. Children need more play to develop their self-regulatory system, that's their stress system in their bodies, to develop all sorts of biological capacities, like whether or not the way a baby learns to crawl and walk influences their motor system and their muscles, influences how they hold a pencil. Lots of parents don't know that. Where would you learn that? Where do you get an opportunity to discover those sorts of things? there are so many opportunities which really excite me and at the same time worry me what we're not curious enough about. And SureStart is, you know, one good example.
It's interesting, back to that classy type thing, because I'm thinking, what are the implications? If a child needs to, a child knows who its mother is, a baby knows who its mother is, a baby, how does a baby then feel when it's offloaded to a nanny to look into its eyes all day?
Okay, that's really interesting. See how you just chose that word, offloaded.
Well, I'm thinking of abdication of responsibility. I mean, STEAMCO is a community engagement thing to get parents and communities to run creativity days. The biggest challenge we have, ironically, is in certain challenge community schools where the parents just won't go. I mean, Thursday, I was heartbroken. A dad said to me, I'm not coming in because I'm going to go home and get stoned. And I wasn't cross with him. It was his sort of circumstances and whatever. But at the other extreme, you've got parents in independent schools who pay significant fees every year. And as far as they're concerned, why would we get involved? We're paying you to educate our kids. We're paying you to look into my baby's eyes.
All of these are important, relevant questions. And ultimately, they all speak to what kind of society do we want to have? And what do we want for our babies? And what do we know to want for our babies? So if we the implications are just the same if we take this all the way up to boarding school. So I had a conversation over email with somebody this week who talked about how he feels that he was damaged by boarding school and that he carries the consequences of that. Now, for some people, boarding school will feel safe. For others, it will feel threatening. And I'm trying to use that example as a way to see that the implications of attachment and connection and the impact on your development stretches across all classes.
And do you think that in that particular case with the boarding schools, is that the impact of the boarding school on them, the bullying, the all-male groups, blah, blah, blah? Is it what they're missing without a proper family group and the mother looking in their eyes again?
Or the dad looking in their eyes.
Yes, sorry.
Or it could be Auntie Helen looking in their eyes. You need one person with whom you feel safe. One person that you know that you can go to if you're distressed. Basically to hold on.
That's interesting, because for me, I wondered if a lot of the baby mother eye contact was because of the 9 months in the womb and hearing the voice.
It is true that the baby, and I just said the baby hears the mother's voice, but the baby will hear the voices of whoever else is around them. But
In the womb.
You could get your big brother, big sister to read stories to the baby every night, and the baby before he or she is born will start to, that will become really familiar, and basically you start to build a relationship with your big brother, big sister. So one of the things to stress here is it's very easy to talk about mothers and babies. And traditionally, developmental psychology looked a lot at that relationship in terms of research. But it's really important to think about all of the relationships that a baby will start to experience, because you can end up putting a whole lot of pressure on mothers, that this becomes about mothers. And if we want a society where men are taking an equal role in that and having the equal joy in time with their children, if that's the kind of society we want, then we can start just by looking at the language that we often use and the kinds of research that's done. So I just have a good time sort of highlighting to people, just in the examples that we come up with, like in this conversation, the kind of frames and expectations that we have about how the world works. And then we can look at those and question again and think, do I want a different kind of world? And how would I help to bring that about? There are tons of dads who don't know this stuff, who feel silly if they're the ones to take the baby to a community support group because it's mostly mothers. Masculinity hasn't taught them that they're allowed to have these kinds of interactions with their babies. I mean, look how far this conversation has ranged. We've now ranged across a whole set of topics, and it all comes out of that one key point, which is that human beings are born already connected to other people, and that we are shaped biologically by the experiences that we have of other people.
I'm glad you took it back to that, not to finish it, I'm afraid. You don't get off that quite that easily. Because when you said it the first time, just then, when you said it in the hall this morning, the phrase that came to mind for me, finishing your sentence, we're all born, I was thinking Picasso, we're all born creative.
Absolutely.
You're sitting down again, because I would love to wind you up and point you off again with that phrase and where we take that.
You're totally right. We are all born creative. We're all born intersubjectively creative, okay? And by that I mean, often when people hear creative, they kind of think of a individually. So you would be good at creating pictures, or you'd be good at writing a song, or you would be good at decorating a room. So in other words, it sounds like creativity is an internal capacity that belongs to a single person. But the amazing thing about being born connected and communicative, although I haven't used that word a lot here, is that we are creative between the two of us. Okay? So the very best example is every sentence I say. I often will have no idea where my sentence is going. Every sentence is creative. And you have no idea what I will say. So you have to stay in tune with what am I saying? Unless, of course, you're bored or you're overwhelmed and you can't stay in tune. And here's the next amazing bit. I finished my sentence. I have no idea what you will say in reply.
Wow, that is a massive, that's an incredible example, isn't it? Because we don't have a day of unfinished sentences, do we? We're just random words. Gosh, that is profound, isn't it?
So we are...
creative communication.
Intersubjectively, and I'm just using a fancy term, but so if you have two subjects, two people, inter is between them. We are born mutually creative.
To create a narrative between us. And
when you start to think, I think that's amazing. When you think every single sentence is creative, it's like mutually creative, because I don't know what you'll say. And I might be too tired to be interested. And what happens if you don't notice that I'm tired? What happens if you get frustrated because I'm not paying attention to you, when actually I'm just too tired? What happens if I'm looking at my mobile phone because that's now standardly what I do in my culture, and I don't notice all the things that you're doing as a baby? So we don't make music together. We don't create those things together, because I live in a different world where I'm now distracted by all this kit. Our babies developing with mobile phones all around them with people are going to develop differently in ways than generations before them. Maybe we should be getting curious about what that is. Maybe there will be some advantages to come out of that. But maybe there will be some real cost that nobody intended to pay. And maybe one of them could be that the nature of our creativity changes. Maybe it declines.
It's interesting that there is that creative versus consumption view, isn't there, with technology? Do we just consume technology, or do we use technological tools to create? And that's possibly another conversation. The extension of the sentence that I just threw in there, we're all born creative. Now, there are people maybe like Robinson or Sagan Robinson or Sugata Mitra or some of those thinkers who might finish that sentence, but we have an education system, a society that teaches that creativity out of us.
Yeah.
And I'm rather naive. I'm just a dad who stumbled into this space. And I've struggled to understand why we would allow that to happen, if we're allowing it to happen. And it comes back to the point you made earlier. We have to ask ourselves about the sort of society we want. Because at one extreme, there are these conspiracy theories that say we're deliberately dumbing people down so they'll just consume and keep quiet because we don't want everybody buzzing around being super creative. Or we're killing creativity because it's quite expensive to give everybody a pot of paint. Or we're killing creativity because, in fact, there are only going to be so many jobs in the creative industries. And so let's make sure that the private educated kids get those, a few kids in grammar schools, because that's our lip service to social mobility. And a few other struggling kids can maybe work their way up and enjoy the creative arts. Whereas, as far as I'm concerned, creativity, the arts, culture, I don't want to just say a birthright. They're a no-brainer if you want a society to function and be fairly content and tick along. It doesn't have to cost the earth.
I agree with you. And I actually think that the constraints are the most widely felt influential constraints are none of the ones that you just named. I think they're cultural.
So I'll give an example. And I hope anybody who's listening to this will laugh, so I'll try and tell it in a funny way. I can remember sitting watching a granddad read to his sort of 2.5-year-old. And you could pick any bouncy book, just take, I don't know, Going on a Bear Hunt. And so this 2.5-year-old was so excited. We're going on a bear hunt, we're going on a bear hunt. That's a really punchy, active story, right? And so if your head is buzzing with ideas like, what might the bear hunt feel like? You know, you're going to go under things and over things and away from the bear. And every time this really loving granddad said to this little girl who would leap up because we're going on a bear hunt, he said, sit down and I'll finish the story.
Right.
So she sat back down. And then we were doing the next page of going on a bear hunt. Going on a bear hunt. You know, we're going to go under things. We're going to go around things. And the little kid was all over the place. And Granddad said, I'm not going to finish the story unless you behave. And I sat and watched that. And I hope everybody's laughing. I hope lots of people will identify with that. We come from a culture that wants children to behave. Because we feel a bit like, if your kid doesn't behave in public, you feel embarrassed. You wonder what the other parents will think of you. You feel ashamed. So you don't want to feel ashamed. And you want your 2-year-old's help. And you might even get mad at your 2-year-old because really what they're doing is that they're off in their own world. And I know we could talk about tantrums and all of that. But the point is, if we live in a society where you feel judged by other people, then if you constrain your child because you're a loving parent or grandparent, because you're just doing what is normal, I see that happen a lot. So we squash the creativity out of our children because we're trying to help them to become good children.
To conform with society's expectations.
And, so then people go, so does that mean that you just have kids running all over the place and today's children don't know how to contain themselves and they don't know how to sit down? And so you can go off on that track. But right now, I'm just trying to help us to think about how you can squash creativity in the excitement of a storybook. Because you're just doing what is normal for your culture. So maybe one way of thinking about how to instill more creativity is that we move more into our discomfort zones. Could we get brave enough as adults to be more often in those discomfort zones? And could we create community spaces that are less likely to shame parents and to make parents feel embarrassed? And what would those look like? What would a really supportive supermarket look like where a parent could go in and would know that if their child is screaming their head off, no one will stand there with often what I call Mrs. McGlinchey at the end of the aisle going, can you keep that child under control? That shames parents.
So is that something that a supermarket could design into their experience, or is this a societal change?
I think it's both. But you could start with supermarkets.
So let's have an example. How might, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm sure you've given this a lot of thought, how might a supermarket design a child, family, mother, father, centered experience?
Okay, here are some ideas off the top of my head. Employ people to just be available, like community child support, smiley face. To help tune in to parents who are feeling anxious themselves. I don't know, put them in a clown suit. So that they're just available so that you're starting to spark more laughter. When you have more laughter, people relax. That's why I worked hard at getting people to laugh at my stories this morning, even though I was talking about kind of like sometimes uncomfortable things. What if you put up information signs all over that says that when you leave your child sitting in that trolley and you go down to the other end of the aisle to find the cereal, for many children that increases anxiety. So they now start to like fiddle or they cry or they start to misbehave. And if you have a parent who then comes back and is irritated with that child because they don't know any of this, and now they're embarrassed because Mrs. McGlinchey is making those eyes at them at the end of the aisle, all you do is wind the child up. What could we do to put information around a supermarket that helps people to think more about children's experiences of shopping? Because very often, children come in when parents are stressed. They've been in childcare all day long and they've got to get home fast because, I don't know, maybe they live in a stereotypical household where daddy is expecting dinner on the table. There are still lots of those households around. So now you have a tense mother, or she's simply tired because she worked all day long. we could, if we understood this stuff, we could come up with creative ways to think about what a more connected supermarket would look like. And some people will say, okay, and now we're going to commercialize that, and supermarkets are going to make money off that as well. Well, that takes us down another line. And maybe, I mean, if that helps families to feel less stressed, well, maybe that's a good form of marketing. I don't know. We could have that conversation.
Well, I think anything that makes somebody feel welcome and gives you an edge over a competitor, any business person's going to like that. It's fascinating talking, and today's been incredible. I mean, just sum up very, very briefly. I mean, you're one of the organisers of this event. Could you just sum up to me the vision behind this and what made you do this today and what you hope people will take away?
Sure. And then we're going to bring this to a lovely close, Nick, because there's a new musical performance to just follow.
Wow.
So, last question. What we're trying to do is help people to understand connection, to help people to think about how you can have more relationship-led practice and policies in schools, in classrooms, to just try to help people to understand the stress system and how relationships help children to manage that, and how we can have kinder schools and kinder communities.
What a way to end it. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you, Suzanne. Let's go and hear this guitar recital now. And thank you so much for having us. It's been great. And thanks for your time now. Appreciate it.
It's been a total pleasure. Real delight.
As I say, I hope you enjoyed that. That was just a wonderful opportunity to sit there and chat with her after her keynote speech at the Portobello Learning Festival. Obviously not run this year, but my goodness, you can count me in for future events. It's just such a lovely bunch of people, a lovely community. And as a direct result of going to the conference, I ended up working in two school communities the 2 days after that. So the conference was on the Sunday. And Saturday, I had Sunday off, and then Monday and Tuesday I ended up in two schools in Edinburgh, one in on the west of Edinburgh and one in Portobello itself, which is the east coast on the beach there in Edinburgh. So yeah, what an adventure. From there I went back to Total Teaching in Hartlepool. I went to work with two or three schools in Hartlepool that I connected with, because don't forget, I had no plans to be up there for that week. So I literally called some schools in Hartlepool and went and worked with them. Some wonderful schools there. Fantastic time at Total Teaching. Saw Chris Dyson speak at that, and I was flattered to be asked to introduce him to the stage. And from there, I think I finally came home 10 days later. I literally had to go to Tesco to buy some clean underwear. It was a shocking, too much information, I'm sure. So thanks very much for checking us out. Stay locked on to the Art Connects 19 podcast. I don't know where this journey is going to take me next, where the podcast journey is going to take me next, but I know one thing, absolutely nothing without you and your support. Thank you so much.